and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week on Addressing Alaskans, Australian Consul General Christopher DeCure. His talk entitled Australia and Alaska, Is China's Demand for Resources Shifting the Balance of Power in the Asia-Pacific Region? Was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on August 26th.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hello, good afternoon, and welcome. I'm Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and thank you, everyone, for coming on this very beautiful day. At the head table today, I'd like to welcome to the very far left, we have John Bittner with the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, who is a partner with us for this event today, and he will introduce our speaker, as well as to his right, Mr. Garrett Wong, who is our new chairman of the board, and we are delighted and thrilled that he is leading our organization this year. John, if you could come up and introduce our speaker.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here today. AEDC has a long history of working with the World Affairs Council on events that we feel expand the awareness of the local business community regarding international opportunities and issues of importance to the Alaskan economy. The fact that Alaska is a global crossroads, both logistically and economically, couldn't be better proven than by the fact that Australia, a country which is located almost 7,800 miles away on the other side of the planet, imports nearly $70 million in Alaskan minerals and products every year. Events like this are a fantastic resource to the state and provide real insights into the economic development opportunities and that international trade represents. In that vein, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce our speaker today, the Australian Consul General, Christopher Paul DeCure. Mr. DeCure took up his appointment as Australian Consul General in Los Angeles in March of 2009. He is a career officer of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade with extensive experience across a range of departmental functions, including Australia's relationship with the U.S. Mr. DeCure has held diverse senior roles in the department covering bilateral and regional relations, trade policy, public affairs, and corporate programs. He has developed a close familiarity with Australia's relations with the United States, having headed the department's Americas division in 2008, and previously served in the Australian Embassy Washington as First Secretary from 1987 to 1990. Mr. DeCure was head of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Task Force in the lead-up to Australia's hosting of the APEC Leaders Meeting in 2007, and he has also played an active role in many Australian consular crises, including as head of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade Crisis Center for the Bali bombing of 2002. And he was awarded an Order of Australia Medal for that contribution to Australians traveling abroad. He holds a Bachelor of Economics from the Australian National University, and he and his wife, Kathy, are proud parents of four adult daughters. He also wanted me to tell you that in Australia, he is an internationally known rugby star, and there they call Brad Pitt the American Christopher DeCure. I'm going to take him at his word. I have no reason to doubt him. He's here today to speak to you on Australia and Alaska. Is China's demand for resources shifting the balance of power in the Asia-Pacific region? Please help me welcome Chris to the podium.
Thanks, John. Well, thank you very much, John, and great to hear I'm a distinguished rugby star, particularly at my age. You know. I enjoy my rugby and did play for a while, but I was certainly a long way from being an international star, I can assure you. But thanks for that very kind introduction, and I'd also like to thank the World Affairs Council of Anchorage for inviting me here today. Garrett and Lisa have been, Lisa in particular, has been very helpful. She picked me up at the hotel at about 10 to 7 this morning to do some media engagements, which was a bit hard on me, but certainly a very rewarding opportunity. It's great to be here, actually. I'm actually a member of the World Affairs Council in Los Angeles, and I have to say we get about the same number of people at our lunches, so I think it's a great credit to the World Affairs Council here that in a city of 10 million people attracts about the same number of participants as you do. So I think that says a lot about this city and its international perspective. I just hope I don't disappoint you too much as a result of this presentation. I'm trying to help the World Affairs Council increase its membership, not decrease it. So we'll see. I think, as John said, this is my second diplomatic appointment in the United States after serving in Washington. And I think there's no doubt that Washington is the centre of the global diplomatic community. That's where all the action is. But I must say, I enjoy working on this side of the continent and in this sort of role, perhaps a little bit more than DC, where you tend to get caught up very much in government-to-government political and strategic engagement. Here it's much more about the people and about business, and that's a part of the work that I really do enjoy on the West Coast. And I've got to also say that, I mean, one of the things that I always say to people is that the West Coast of the United States is very different to the East Coast, having served there. And, you know, for Australians, you know, America's a big place and it's a big homogenous place, and they don't always understand that there are differences here, and it's many different communities who have obviously one set of values and so forth, but often quite different perspectives on the world, different senses of humour, different ways of doing business, and so forth. I used to always say everybody in Washington wants to be president and everybody in New York wants to be a billionaire, and they're very focused on that. So it's great to come out here and see a broader perspective sometime. I think it was the thing I always recall, I was in Washington when President Reagan was in the White House, and one of the things he used to say is that if the Pilgrim Fathers had landed on the west coast of the United States, the East would still be unpopulated. And there might be something in that, I think. Yeah. I must say, too, on a personal note, in the few days that I've been here in Alaska, I've really been overwhelmed by the welcome that I've got here from the people of Alaska, the willingness to help out and to help me better understand what's happening in this part of the country. And, of course, the natural beauty of this state is something that I think you really do have to experience to really appreciate, and the weather's done the right thing and cleared up for me so that we can see these mountains in the background with the snow and, you know, the peaks, something we don't see a lot of in Australia. I do want to talk a little bit about Australia's engagement in Asia and about China and those sorts of things, but before that, you're going to have to cop a bit of a commercial from me. I want to talk a little bit about Australia, what we're doing at the moment, where we're at, and also our relationship with the United States, and a bit more about what we're doing here in Alaska, and then talk a bit more about our broader view of the world, and particularly of Asia, and the way we've engaged with Asia. I think talking about Alaska too, I mean, we do have a lot in common with Alaska when I come here, and it's become more apparent to me visiting here. I mean, not least, I think they're probably two of the few places in the world where you hear this reference to Captain Cook, James Cook, you know, because he, of course, the British explorer that, you know, first landed here and claimed Alaska for Britain or for England about, you know, a couple of years after he did the same in Australia. The only difference is that in both cases, I think he looked at them and said, these are fairly barren lands that really we'll claim and stick a flag in, but we won't bother populating. That was the case in Australia until England couldn't find anywhere to put all their prisoners, so they shipped a bunch of them out to Australia. You didn't cop that same fate. They just handed it over to the Russians, I think. So, you know, but our early experiences were very similar. I should also say that when Cook claimed Australia and Alaska, he didn't really recognise much the fact that there was in fact an Aboriginal population in both the countries that sort of had a view on that, and that's something that I think both of us really left unresolved for many, you know, years, and it's really only in the last, I guess, 50 years or so that both have made a concerted effort to address some of those issues. But I think the similarities don't just end with Captain Cook. Both of us have custody of really quite harsh environments in many respects. Beautiful environments, but harsh, but quite different. You know, here it's cold and wet, if you include ice as water. Australia, particularly in our remote regions, tends to be warm and certainly very dry, but nonetheless harsh, long distances between places, population scattered around, mostly in the coastal regions, in the warmer parts of the land, but for the most part having to deal with quite a diverse population. And dealing with that, what we call Australia often, the tyranny of distance, which initially was that a long way from the rest of the world, but increasingly is about the distances within our country. How do you ensure that you provide services and telecommunications and health and education and so forth to communities spread out over such large transportation, large distances? And particularly in both our cases, how do you develop your mineral resources and your energy resources when they're located in probably the most remote parts of both our countries? And that's a real challenge, and I think that is an area of opportunity for closer collaboration. And I think in the broader sense too, we have a Pacific perspective on the world because we're on the Pacific Ocean. We see what's happening in Asia and see the opportunities that presents. And I think at the moment, that's a very good place to be, frankly, in this what we call the Asia Century, you know, Pacific Century. I know at the moment, our three biggest trading partners are China, Japan and Korea, followed by India. You have the same three largest trading partners, so there are a lot of similarities there. And we're selling minerals, we're selling energy products, and we're selling agricultural products, termed loosely. I made the mistake before correcting myself yesterday and talking to some people about referring to aquaculture here, but of course it's not aquaculture because you're catching wild fish and exporting them around the world. So, whereas for us it's very much land-based, wheat and meat and so forth. I think, and the other thing, and probably the most important thing we have in common is that we've both nurtured domestic film and television industries, you know, very effectively. And I guess for us in the early days, it was Paul Hogan with Crocodile Dundee, and more recently, Steve Irwin, the Crocodile Hunter. There's a crocodile theme there. But you, and I know my wife is an avid follower of a bunch of Alaskan reality TV shows. You know, we've got the Ice Truckers and, of course, Deadliest Catch, the fish, Flying Wild Alaska with Era Aviation, and of course Sarah Palin's Alaska. I guess the one thing that I haven't quite worked out why there isn't something like that on the Iditarod. I mean, that seems to be the obvious thing to cover in a reality show. And we have back in the consulate in LA a real keen interest in the Iditarod because every year, well, at least for the last 2 years, we've had what we call a sweep, where essentially all the teams are put into a hat and we take it in turns to pull out the names and they become our teams for the race. And typically, we're a small office, we get three or four each. I've had the distinction of coming last the last 2 years, so I'm not very happy. I've come up here to find out what the secret of the Iditarod is, see if I can select better next time. Anyway, now perhaps to Australia. Just a bit of a context for where Australia fits in the world. We're the only country to occupy an entire continent, and that's a big challenge. And while we tend to be known for our outback, which I guess Alaska is as well, the reality is that most of our population lives in cities around the southeast part of the state or the eastern coast increasingly. And we are known to be probably the most urbanised country in the world, which is a little ironic given that sort of perception of Australia. We're the 13th largest economy in the world at the moment. So, you know, I mean, it's big by US terms, not so big. I mean, we're sort of less than the size of California really as an economy, but still, you know, fairly large. We're only 22 million people, so, you know, we can't do it all in one go. And the fourth largest economy in the Asian region after China, Japan and India. I think like the United States too, we're one of the oldest continuing democracies in the world. You know, we're deeply committed to the extension of those diplomatic values really across the globe, like the United States. And the other thing I guess that's sort of unique about us is we do regard ourselves these days particularly as part of that sort of Asian hemisphere. Not an Asian country, but part of that hemisphere. I mean, that's sort of where we operate. That's our part of the world, and it's something that we've, you know, worked very hard at coming to know better. As I mentioned, we are the 13th largest economy in the world. We have a GDP of about $1.3 trillion at the moment and per capita income of about $57,000. So, you know, it's a fairly wealthy country in general terms, and a lot of that is driven by that mineral wealth. And the global financial crisis that we had a couple of years, you know, has been a major preoccupation challenge really for the whole world, but we've been very fortunate, like Alaska really, to have avoided the worst of that. We had one quarter of downturn back in the September quarter of 08 after the crisis, and we've had another one since then in the first quarter of this year, but that was because of major flooding in Queensland, which is one of our major mining areas. So a number of our mines were just shut down for several periods, and we lost about 2% of our GDP for that quarter. But apart from that, we've really sailed through and continued to grow. Our unemployment's running at about 5%, so effectively, full employment, we certainly regard it as full employment, and we're starting, in fact, even to see some inflationary pressure driven as a result of that. And there's several reasons, I think, why we survived that financial crisis very well, one of which was, frankly, good luck, having those resources at a time when countries like China and India were just exploding in terms of their demand for those resources. I mean, just to give you a sense of that, our trade with China has increased 40-fold in the last 20 years, and the last year increased by 40%, and that's been the trend over recent years. So, and India is a bit the same, but coming off a lower base. So that's obviously creating an enormous amount of economic activity for us and boosting our GDP. But also, I think, to be fair, there's a lot of good management, good governance that helped that along. We went into the financial crisis with a no government debt, so we actually had a bit of a surplus in some funds to set aside for some set aside for education, building construction, and some to pay for pensions for government officials like myself, which were unfunded at that point. So we started from a very strong position. So going into the crisis, when income was down and there was a need to provide some stimulus, we're able to do that without getting into really serious financial trouble. And next year, we expect our budget to go back into surplus after a couple of years of deficits. But still, our deficit's probably going to be around 13 or 14% of GDP, so a relatively small amount of money. And the other thing that, because we have very strong prudential regulation, we didn't have any banks go broke, and we didn't have any corporations that needed to be bailed out to protect the economy. So that was a huge benefit for us. The housing sector held up well because employment held up. I think that that certainly helped a lot. I mentioned the impact of trade, and particularly trade with Asia, and about 22% of our GDP is sourced from trade. Was that my phone? No, sorry. As I said, 22% of our GDP comes from trade. About half of that from mineral exports. So it's a very significant part of our trade, of our certainly our goods trade anyway. Agriculture is about 14%, and manufacture is about 18%. And our big exports are coal, iron ore, gold, petroleum, and natural gas is the big sleeper that's growing very rapidly. We're currently the world's fourth largest exporter of liquid natural gas and liquefied natural gas, and probably will be number two between Qatar within 10 years. And so there's been a huge amount of development in that area. Currently about $10 billion a year, but that'll grow quite rapidly. Huge investments by some of the companies that are here, actually, including ConocoPhillips, who's one of the sponsors today, and as well as Chevron. And I think on the services side, education and tourism are very big export items for us. We get a lot of tourists into Australia, and we sell education services, particularly into Asia, India, China, Korea, and so forth. And just to give a sense of the emphasis on Asia in our trade and in our economic relationship, 9 of our top 10 trading partners are in Asia. The only one that's not is Britain, the UK. All the others are in the Asia Pacific region, if you include the US in that as part of that Asia Pacific region. So all of our economic focus and a lot of our political focus is in this region. And so we're obviously very interested in what's happening in China and keen to endorse that, but also India and other parts of the region, and particularly some of the countries closest to us, like Indonesia. But from our perspective, the US is really, the cornerstone of our global engagement and our regional engagement, for that matter. Our first links to the United States go back to shortly after our federation as a country, which was only 1901, so about 110 years ago. but shortly after that. And really for a period, probably 30 or 40 years after that, a lot of our foreign policy was still run out of Britain. So, you know, it was sort of a partial, it was a gradual process. And I remember when the famous Great White Fleet from the United States decided to tour the world to, as a sort of show of US emergence, I guess, the Australian Prime Minister wrote to the President at the time and invited the Great White Fleet to visit Australia. This caused great consternation in Britain because they felt that we should have submitted that request through London, and they probably would have ensured the letter got lost, I think, because they would not have been keen at that point, at least, for that change to occur. But, you know, we still have a very close relationship and engagement with Britain, but the US is really the cornerstone of our international engagement. We signed a treaty, or if you like, an alliance treaty with the United States in San Francisco about 60 years ago in about 3 or 4 days, the 1st of September. We're going to commemorate that in San Francisco in the coming weeks. As I said, we had this Great White Fleet visit, and that was the first time that Australians really got to understand America as a country. And we had long visits in Melbourne and Sydney and Perth, I think, as well, where the ships stop. And we had national holidays and big street balls. I had to be careful not to say brawls, but there were some of those as well, I think. But mostly balls and so forth. So it was a great occasion for Australia, and that created the foundations. And really, since that time, Australians and Americans have fought alongside each other in every major conflict, I think, since that time. And we're talking about World War I, obviously, World War II. And in fact, one of the little-known facts, World War I, the first US soldiers to be involved in World War I, in fact, fought as part of an Australian battalion. They were under Australian command, I think. Since then, I think it's been more the other way, but that was a first. It was in Europe. But since then, yeah, obviously World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam War, the Gulf War, Afghanistan, Iraq and so forth, we've been there. And that's been an important part of that alliance. And we're also, of course, working very closely together on the War on Terror, which has been a major preoccupation for all of us over the last, since 9/11. That ANZUS Treaty, as we call it, is really something that's greatly valued and understood in Australia, and I think people recognise the importance of it and the fact that the US has agreed to stand by us in difficulty is something that's appreciated. But we also feel as though we need to keep our side of that bargain, so it's not a one-way thing by any means. So we don't take that security for granted. You know, our defence expenditure ranks about 14th in the world, so it's fairly significant. And our military is highly interoperable with the US military. So, you know, we do a lot of training together, and, you know, we've got some Australians up here, pilots up here training with the US people out at the Air Force Base here, and really right around the country we find that. So they work together quite seamlessly because they've trained together and they use a lot of the same equipment. So that's really the foundation for our sort of international engagement, first and foremost, is the alliance with the United States. From there, we look towards Asia as, and particularly its emergence as the centre of the global economy after a 200-year-odd hiatus. And I guess we often forget that China and India were very big and global powers just 200 or 300 years ago. So in a sense, it's not a new thing. It's a re-emergence after a period. So, I mean, this is something that really, from our perspective, really matters to us and matters to the United States. You know, and quite clearly the centre of the global economy is shifting to the Pacific Ocean, as I said earlier, and that's something we want to exploit. And I think that's something that's... my sense is that's something that's really understood here in Alaska very well because you're so close to the region. It's reasonably well understood, I think, across the United States, but not universally, I think, and certainly in other parts of the world. I'm just not sure that they fully comprehend what's actually happening in Asia and how quickly those countries are emerging as massive countries. And, you know, it's interesting, I was doing some reading recently and I saw a quote from President Teddy Roosevelt back in, over 100 years ago now, and quite prophetic, I think. What he said, this is 1903, he said, "The Atlantic era, now at its height of development, must soon exhaust the resources at its command. The Pacific era is destined to be the greatest of all. It's just at its dawn." That's something over 100 years ago, and I think that's quite prophetic. I wonder, though, whether he would have even anticipated the scale of that growth, at least in recent times. You know, Asia's home to 3.8 billion people, so it's half the world's population. According to the Asian Development Bank, it's going to nearly double its share of global GDP from 27% to 51% by mid-century, so around 2050. So, you know, I mean, that's a huge amount of growth, and I think it's already, in fact, for the last 20 years, I think Asia really has accounted for well over half of global economic growth anyway. China's obviously the major driver of this ascendancy, and I think has every chance of surpassing the United States and the European Union as a group to become the world's largest economy sometime in the next 20 years or so. And this is at a time when Japan, you know, will remain one of the world's largest economy. Korea is going to continue to grow at a fairly rapid rate, and Indonesia could become the world's fifth largest economy within that period as well, a very big population. So, you know, you've got huge shifts there. So I don't think any country in the world can ignore that shift. You know, and I think particularly China and India, you know, the two real engines of growth in the region. You know, I think you think about it, if the Chinese economy collapsed tomorrow, I think we'd all be in a lot of trouble for a variety of reasons. And I think the good news is that certainly from Australia's perspective, and I think also Alaska's, we're very well placed to take advantage of this economic transformation. Firstly, for proximity to the region. And I know at the international airport here, virtually all of the air traffic that travels between Asia and the US travels through Alaska, through the airport here. And somebody said to me last night, you know, everything that starts with iPod, iPad, iPhone, whatever, they all come through here on their way from assembly in China. So, you know, that's something that's well understood. And secondly, I think we both have energy and mineral resources that these countries are desperate for. And if we can access those and to fuel those economies, then I think we'll benefit. And we are benefiting. I mean, that's quite clear. You know, I think like Alaska, it's this energy and minerals trade that's fueling the growth of our trade with Asia, as I said earlier. So, you know, it should come as no surprise, I guess, that the core of foreign policy challenge for Australia in the first half of this century is to make sure that we handle that relationship with China, but also with India, in a sensible and prudent manner. And encourage China to cooperate with its neighbours and the rest of the world. I mean, this is obviously critically important to all of us. And I think when I first arrived in Los Angeles to take up my job, I found a couple of things, I mean, one of which was a sort of a bit of a lack of confidence in the US that I hadn't encountered before. You know, some parts of the community anyway, and particularly the perception that somehow the fact that China as an economy might overtake the US as the largest economy was a sign of decline in the US. I think that's just not right. I mean, certainly China is on this sort of trajectory, US is on this one. It's inevitable with 1.4 billion people versus, you know, to 300 million that you're going to have that sort of situation occur. But the US is going to continue to be the engine of innovation, and certainly per capita incomes are going to remain well above those of China for, you know, the foreseeable future. So that was something that surprised me a little bit, and I think it was probably the aftermath of the economic crisis and, you know, or the financial crisis, and just a sense that, you know, maybe the US was in serious trouble. I just don't see that. Secondly, when I came here, I found this conversation about China quite different to the one in Australia. I think I found in the sections of the US community here a real sort of wariness and even concern about, and you know, some of that's legitimate, about the rise of China, and particularly its growing assertiveness, you know, in bilateral, regional and sort of global affairs, being a little bit more aggressive about its position. There's been less anxiety about that in Australia, and I don't know whether that's unfounded or not, but I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I think there's certainly very strong community support in Australia for building a sort of comprehensive, constructive and cooperative relationship with China. And that's not because we're particular visionaries on China or anything of that nature. I think it's something that's occurred because there's a mutual benefit in all of that. You know, We've had a long history of engagement with modern China, communist China, if you like, dating back to the early 70s. But more importantly, we've derived enormous economic benefit, as I've said, from China. So it's very hard to see a country in a negative light when they're paying your bills, I guess. And I think that's been a factor. We've focused on China and have a greater familiarity with them. And I think also because we see ourselves as an integral part of that Asia-Pacific region, and therefore we tend to view the world through that Asian prism, and China is part of that and a key part of that, so we see that. And so I think that's where those differences occur. I think probably in Alaska here, we may see a little bit of that as well because of the benefits that flow here. But I think if you look more broadly in the United States, there's a bunch of issues out there that are really seen to be causing anxiety and raising concerns of people, and I think they're all legitimate issues. I mean, China's military and weapons development, which people look at with some concern. Human rights issues, which are very important for all of us, certainly in Australia and the United States. A large trade deficit with China, which is a source of tension. Obviously, for us, it's the reverse. We have a huge surplus with China, but here you have that tension that arises from a trade deficit. I certainly saw that, 20 years ago when I was in Washington in relation to Japan, so it's not just about China. Loss of manufacturing capacity is another one that you hear a lot of, and I guess that becomes an issue, particularly when your economy is a little bit depressed. People are looking at where the jobs are going, and again, in Australia, because unemployment is so low and a lot is being exported to China, we have less concern about that. Intellectual property protection, big issue for the United States because you are, as I said, the engine of innovation, and therefore, enormous proportion of sort of global patents and trademarks and so forth are sourced here. So you need to be concerned about loss of intellectual property to China. And I guess the currency valuation issue is another one that tends to generate a lot of angst here, concern that the Chinese currency is undervalued and making it very difficult for American companies to compete. But I think from our perspective, it's certainly true that China's evolving as a regional military power that could alter the strategic status quo in the Asia-Pacific region. And I think India is in that mix as well, as I said, just a little bit refined. We've, in Australia, have given a lot of thought to this, and particularly our strategic response to the challenges and opportunities that are posed by China's re-emergence as a world power. But our view is that the world's entitled to seek clarification of Chinese ambitions, but should understand, really, that an extension of China's foreign policy and security influence is sort of a natural consequence of its economic rise. It's inevitable when you rise economically, you start to reach out a bit. The question is, how far do you reach out, and what are the rules under which you engage internationally? And I think that's the thing that we've focused on. It's okay for China to have a capacity, but what are the ambitions, and how do you ensure that they are managed? So we proceed on the basis that a prosperous China, actively and constructively engaged in regional and world affairs, is good for Australia and good for the world. We don't want an isolationist China. I think that would be a very dangerous thing. We also proceed on the basis that China's rise as a regional power is inevitable, but its emergence as a threat, is not inevitable. It's something that is a possibility, but is not inevitable by any means. And so sensible policy should be aimed at having China itself conclude that ultimately the maintenance of a liberal rules-based order is in fact in China's own intrinsic interests. We don't sort of really subscribe to this notion that we need to choose between our alliance with the United States and our economic future with China. And we also believe it vitally important that we have continued full engagement of the United States in the Asia-Pacific region. That's vital, I think, to the peace and security as well as the economic prosperity of the region, because it's US, the rise of Asia has occurred because of the role that US has played in keeping the peace in the region, and the fact that some of the countries in the region have emerged and have become stronger doesn't diminish the important role that the US plays. I mean, you are an Asia-Pacific power and you should remain that way, and that's certainly our view. We also believe that China recognises that its neighbours in North Asia there valued what we've seen as a renewed US commitment to constructive engagement in the region. And our sense is too is that the region is big enough for to accommodate sort of some healthy competition for friends and influence with China. So, you know, we really expect the US will continue to be not just a global player, but a critical player in the Asia-Pacific region, and that certainly seems to be the US government's objective, and we welcome that. You know, there's some people who believe that China's military power is a threat to the United States, regional security and the global order, and particularly drawing comparisons between China and the Soviet Union of the Cold War days. And I think that's a mistake. China's quite different to the Soviet Union, I think, as many as you would appreciate. The latter was very much an insular regime that operated with its satellites, chose to largely close itself off from the liberal world, both economically and politically, behind that Iron Curtain. But China, on the other hand, you know, has a truly global and increasingly free market economy that relies heavily on its trade and investment relationships with the world, and particularly with the United States and its other Asia-Pacific neighbours for its growth. So it's a country that cannot afford to make enemies, basically. It has to, you know, I mean, if it didn't have the US market, you know, it also would be in a lot of trouble. So I think, to put it simply, the prosperity of the Chinese people is tied to the prosperity and peace in the Asia-Pacific region, and its sort of smooth emergence as a free market economy. So a lot of Australia's diplomacy in the region has been based on, I guess, two things. Firstly, working bilaterally with our regional neighbours to strengthen them and to make sure that, you know, they play a role in the global strategic environment. And secondly, to cooperate with those countries, including China, at a regional level, to establish rules and build mechanisms and institutions in Asia or in the Asia Pacific that encourage cooperation, reduce tensions, and smooth the tectonic shifts in the regional strategic and economic environment. So on the economic front, we work very closely with the United States to promote Asia-Pacific trade, economic liberalisation in the region, and to help build structures to promote economic integration. So there's a lot of things. I mean, we talked earlier about APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, which is designed to promote economic cooperation in the region. But one of its offshoots is that in Seattle, here in the United States, for the first time, when the US hosted, President Clinton hosted a meeting of leaders from the region. And that's been an annual meeting since then. A vitally important meeting, because it's a meeting where the US President and the Chinese President, Japanese Prime Minister and Russian President and so forth are all in the one room together. And, you know, I've sat through several of those meetings and watched them interact. And it's a great opportunity, because they do interact quite informally at those meetings, and it does serve a role, I think, in improving understanding and reducing tensions. So, but more importantly, it's actually promoting economic integration, which I think helps to reduce some of those other tensions and as I said, makes creates an incentive for people to get on rather than not. I think if there is a dark cloud in this whole, what's happening in the region, is that we still really don't have sort of regional institutions dealing with security issues. So the security engagement is still quite brittle, and I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done in that area, because economic integration alone doesn't solve problems. I think it can reduce tensions, but if there are tensions, what are the rules? What are the mechanisms that we can use to address those issues and try and resolve them? There are obviously territorial disputes right around the region, and I think we shouldn't underestimate the brittleness of that security environment. The US has played a critical role in keeping, you know, a lid on some of those tensions in Asia, but we need to be conscious of that. So we've sought to address that in Australia by developing stronger bilateral security engagement, not just with the United States, but with Japan and with Korea, with Indonesia and other countries in the region. We're certainly stepping up to defence and strategic engagement with China, you know, to work with them a little bit. And then we're also increasing our defence budget to look at or to deal with what we see as potential uncertainties, not inevitabilities, but uncertainties. Australia has also argued consistently and vociferously that the security dynamics in East Asia can be better managed if we develop a greater sense of common security across the Asia-Pacific region with the US as a key player, and that's critical. And I think that's starting to emerge now. There's the East Asia Summit, which is a new organisation that's really just evolved from an Asian-focused group to include the US president will be there for the first time this year in Indonesia. But it will include the prime ministers and president of India and Russia and all of the Asian countries, as well as Australia and New Zealand. And that's vitally important because that will deal with strategic issues. APEC has tended to deal mostly with economic issues, with security issues dealt within the margins. I think the fact that the Asians have agreed that this sort of forum should exist with all of us in that group, I think, is a very encouraging sign and an indication that they see a role, particularly for the United States, but also for humble Australia in those sorts of processes. So I might stop there. I mean, there's some other things I could talk about, but I think it's probably more important that you tell me what you'd like to hear from me on and move ahead. But if I could just conclude by making, I guess, a couple of points. Firstly, talking about Australia and Alaska, we're not big trading partners. I mean, that's obvious, but we've got a lot in common, a lot to share, and I think there is significant opportunities for greater economic engagement between the two of us in investment, technology in the mining, energy, and also in tourism, I think, where we have a lot of common areas of common interest. And I think the second point is we shouldn't assume that the economic and strategic rise of China is a threat to our security and to the US role in Asia, but rather it's an opportunity, albeit one that's going to require close management at the bilateral level and a strengthening of Asia-Pacific dialogue, rules and institutions. I guess they're the two key messages from this sort of broad presentation. So thanks for your patience. Very happy to take questions now.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Australian Consul General Christopher DeCure. Recorded on August 26th at the Alaska World Affairs Council, Mr. DeCure responded to questions from audience members following his talk entitled Australia and Alaska, Is China's Demand for Resources Shifting the Balance of Power in the Asia-Pacific Region?
Thank you very much. I wonder if you could comment a little bit about the Australian government's view of climate change issues and maybe how that will affect the Australian continent and, I guess, the future of your economy and security and a lot of issues there.
Look, it's a big issue for Australia, quite clearly, for several reasons. I think one of which we have a fragile climate, as you well know, as you do, and so that can be affected significantly by climate change. Secondly, we're a major energy exporter, and particularly a exporter of coal and petroleum products and so forth, gas, all products that that I guess emit carbon. So I guess we have that. But that said, the Australian government is committed to introducing measures to reduce carbon emissions in Australia, and in fact announced just a couple of weeks ago that we will that they will look to pass legislation in your fall, I guess, in the coming months, that would introduce a fixed carbon price in Australia from 1 July of next year. That would be $23 a tonne, and that would increase by about 2.5% over the following 3 years, and then we would have a carbon regime 3 years after that, so a trading regime. So that's been announced. There are several elements to that plan that sit alongside the carbon tax, and that is, some people don't like to call it a tax, you know, it doesn't work very well. Introducing things like using some of that funding to support research into clean technology, but also alternative and renewable energy sources to help consumers who are worst affected by the inevitable increase in electricity and other fuel prices, and also to provide at least some temporary assistance for what we call carbon-intensive trade industries. So companies that are exporting goods that produce a heavy amount of carbon, obviously their costs and their competitiveness their costs would have the potential to make them less competitive, so some support for them in the short term. To be frank, it's been a a difficult conversation in Australia, and I think the public debate on this has probably been evenly split between those that support and those that oppose, but the government's taken a stand and said we'll do this, and as I said, the legislation will be in our parliament in the coming weeks.
Hi, Chris.
No questions from you.
Didi Hitchens, British Honorary Consul. Can you talk a little bit about Australia's relationship with their Indigenous people? It's something else that you share with Alaska, having a dynamic Indigenous people. And as I think you know, Indigenous people here are very much involved in the economic development and development of the resources. And I know in Australia they had an apology just a few years back from the Prime Minister. Mm. Would you talk a little bit about how that's going?
Yeah, sure, thanks, Didi. That was not a planted question, I can assure you, but we did have a conversation about this. And in fact, it's something that I've had several conversations with here in my time in Alaska, and that is another area of, I think, common interest. You know, as I said at the outset, we both had Indigenous communities here when Captain Cook arrived. Their position and their existence here for thousands of years before we arrived was really not acknowledged all that effectively until relatively recently. Now, I know you had land titles legislation passed in 71, I think it was. We're a little bit later than you in doing that. But, I mean, essentially, there's a lot of effort going into Indigenous disadvantage in Australia and I guess, disempowerment and the first step, I guess, in addressing that, or the first major step, was to provide or recognition that sort of native title, as we call it in Australia. That's a starting point because, like here, Australian Aboriginal people are so attached to their land, that's really, you know, the focus of their existence. There have been a range of things that have happened since then, and frankly, it's still a very difficult path. We have the same issues in Australia as you have here with a number of Indigenous communities living in quite remote areas, in small communities, some of them still, you know, nomadic and living in subsistence lifestyles. But there's sort of an obligation to provide infrastructure, health and medical services, education, all of those issues, employment, and that's a real challenge. I think, frankly, in Australia, we've thrown a lot of money at that. But I think both sides of politics in Australia would acknowledge we sort of haven't quite got it right, and so really interested in what's happening here with some of the Indigenous corporations and NANA. I know one that have had discussions with people from that organisation. I think what's happening there is quite promising, and I think getting the balance between providing employment opportunities and providing and bringing in external expertise, I think, has been a critical part of that. You know, recognising that, you know, from day one, you can't expect a community that's not dealt with corporations law and with business and so forth could suddenly become, be able to manage the resources at their disposal as effectively as they might. But equally, you don't want a situation where that's always imposed on them. You know, you need to be able to create, if you are going to have people coming from outside to provide those capabilities, they need to be training up the locals, and I think that's something that some of these corporations have done very effectively, and I'd like to learn a little bit more about that. But we've done a number of things. As I said, the land rights issue was a critical one. I think a national apology by our Prime Minister, what was it now, 4 years ago, so that was fairly recent. And there's a lot of talk now about enshrining something in our constitution that formally recognises the position of the original owners of that country. So I think the short answer is a lot of the same sorts of experiences here. It's something that won't change overnight. It's a generational thing in many respects. But there's certainly a lot of commitment, a lot of effort and a lot of money being put into it in Australia. But it's often those symbolic things like the apologies for past wrongs and the land rights issues that create a sense of identity and increase the possibility that we can actually resolve some of those outstanding challenges.
Thank you very much for your remarks. I'm a Foreign Service officer with the Department of State. I just returned from Cambodia. I was there for a year, and prior to that, New Zealand for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask a domestic policy question, but before I do, I'm not speaking for the Department of State, but I have always maintained that Australia is our number two ally behind Britain And I would argue that with anybody. And the Kiwis always have a hard time dealing with this. I have a Kiwi next to me here. We haven't discussed it yet, but when I served in Wellington, this was a big issue. Australia is number two. And we can even argue that maybe be number one, really, in some ways. But I do correct you. ANZUS is dead. There is no more ANZUS as such. You know that.
Well, it's still a treaty. But I think there's one party out of it.
NZ's out of it. Yeah, that's right. We don't stand...
Talk about that, but we still call it ANZUS.
Well, I don't think we do, but anyway. My domestic question, though, is about domestic property prices. You mentioned housing, so I want to bring up the issue. I was reading an article not long ago about Australian government policy, tax policy, regarding investment properties and what it's doing, why it's pricing out young couples. As you know, I've been going to Australia a long, long time. I remember the Central Coast is now developed north of Sydney. It used to be farmland. A lot of couples live up there, young families, because they can't afford Sydney real estate. And this article was about what government policy can do to make housing more affordable for first-time home buyers. I wonder, I don't want to put you on the spot, but maybe you're familiar with the issue. Maybe you can talk a little bit about whether the government recognizes this as an issue, basically to try to limit investors from coming in and buying up, in terms of speculation, property and bidding up property prices in the big cities.
Yeah, I mean, I won't spend too much time on this because I suspect there are probably two or three people in the room that are actually interested in this topic and the rest not. But yeah, we have a different situation. I mean, in Australia, for instance, you can't claim a tax deduction on interest you pay on your home, but you don't pay capital gains tax. But with investment properties, a lot of people, you can claim a tax deduction on interest paid on an investment property. And that's the point you're making, that people often buy property to claim a tax deduction and, you know, pay some rent and essentially accumulate equity in that property, which you do, incidentally, pay capital gains on. I mean, this is not a policy issue, but I've heard both sides of that argument, one of which is, look, you just need to make more land available and, you know, there's something in that. The other issue, frankly, is that once you create value in property, and it's a bit like farmland, you know, but if you set prices high, farmland prices rise, then you take that away, you know, you send a lot of people broke. And so you've got to be very careful about how you manage any change. We've got comprehensive review of our taxation policy going on in Australia at the moment. There's a paper due out shortly and there'll be a discussion over the next year or two about the tax mix in Australia and what's the most efficient way to do that. And I think this is an issue that will come up there, but it's one that will have to be managed, I think, fairly carefully.
Good day from a fellow retired rugby player.
Excellent. You look like one. Well, you look like a prop now. I suspect you weren't in younger days.
I was a wing.
Oh, yeah.
The question.
Good living here in Alaska, huh?
What's that?
Good living here in Alaska, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, sorry.
The question I have is, how does Australia deal with China as far as the communist, capitalist, you know, human rights issues? And that was my question.
Yeah. I mean, there's no denying China is a communist country, but it's, as I said, it's a little bit different to Russia. I mean, in the sense that they are gradually, their market is becoming increasingly free market, and I think probably, while they might not say so publicly, quite clearly they recognise the benefits of free markets and open economies because they've benefited hugely from that. And I think there's a demand for that from their people. But, you know, it still is a communist country, but there are a lot of those around the world. On human rights, that's an issue that we take up with the Chinese regularly. We tend to do that more privately than publicly. I think the government has a view that it's better to have a constructive engagement on those sorts of issues and keep working away. And certainly for a country like Australia, that seems to be the most effective way to pursue those issues. But we don't ignore them. They're part of the mix of the relationship. But, you know.
Thank you very much.
Let's see.
Uh-oh.
I just want to make sure I get this right.
You going to phone a friend?
Well, you know. Wait, you're the one answering. In Alaska, we're constantly discussing natural gas development.
Mm-hmm.
And you briefly alluded to Australia's development of its resources and the investment that has come into the country as a result of that. How has the average Australian benefited from investment resulting from development of your resources?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Some would say they haven't, but no, the reality is that we haven't had in a financial or economic crisis over the last years. We've had continuous growth, certainly at an annual level, for the last 20 years, and that's largely because of that resource development and sales into Asia. That said, I mean, there is a conversation in Australia about a, in a sense, a two-step economy. So you have those that are involved in the resources sectors doing very well, and those that perhaps aren't are not doing as well. And that's a challenge. But the reality is that those resources sectors generate income and wealth for the country, increase taxes and so forth. And appreciate the value of our dollar, which means that Australians can come to the US very cheaply and have a holiday. So there are the benefits there. But, I mean, certainly people who are living in those resources areas are earning very good incomes and some other parts of the country not as much. But, frankly, no one's, I think, suffering. I mean, we've got unemployment at 5%, so that tells you a big part of the story, I think. Mm.
Hi, I'm a student.
I was about to say, are we going to get one of the students have a question?
I have a question about there was a drought a couple of months back.
A couple of years. It's running longer than you've been on this earth, I suspect. But
and I'm just wondering, how has it impacted the economy?
Look, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you're right, the drought, we had a 10-year drought, or at least a 10-year drought. In Australia, and it got very severe, and to the point really where some towns were running out of water or had run out of water. Most of our major cities had built desalination plants, the ones around the city, as a backup, because you know water levels in dams have reduced below sort of 20% of capacity. For a long while in Australia, we hadn't been allowed to wash cars, water gardens or plants other than with a bucket and those sorts of things. So there have been very severe water restrictions, even in major cities. And irrigated crops and so forth had obviously been affected as well. Water's always been an issue for Australia. We have a severe shortage of it, and that's why we've only got 22 million people in a continent that size. But it was having a significant impact, and it was certainly having an impact on our agricultural exports. So our grain exports, particularly wheat, were down quite dramatically during that period. Fortunately, that drought broke about 12 months ago, and so what we've seen over the last 12 months is that our agricultural exports have come back quite strongly, because a lot of what we produce in the agricultural area is exported. So the drought's been a severe issue for us, but what it has done is change behaviour. And I think that's an area, for instance, in California, we spend quite a lot of time talking to officials in California and Colorado and elsewhere in the Southwest about our experience with water management and water pricing. You talk to the mayor of San Diego, right at the end of the Colorado River, you know, he sounds like the mayor of Adelaide, which is at the mouth of our major river system. So, you know, they're at the end of the line. There's not much water left in the river by the time it gets to them. You're having these battles between farm groups and city groups about who should have access to water. So it's a big issue for us, and it's something that we've been able to share with our friends and colleagues in US states. It's been quite a productive and useful conversation. Good question.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Liz.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Australian Consul General Christopher DeCure. Mr. DeCure responded to questions from the audience following his talk entitled Australia and Alaska, Is China's Demand for Resources Shifting the Balance of Power in the Asia-Pacific Region? It was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on August 26, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening. Did you know that there is an Alaska World Affairs Council podcast available every week on alaskapublic.org? Volunteers Michael Cook and William Toyer record the Alaska World Affairs Council luncheons every week to share with you on alaskapublic.org. To find out more, go to alaskapublic.org and click on podcasts. at the bottom of the page.